Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 34. On this episode, we talk Boyhood, an independent film that will round out our summer series of so many reviews. So thanks for, you know, like tuning in to all these extra reviews. Maybe it's gone so well that this might continue, that you get more than two reviews. We'll see. It depends on how lucky you guys are. But like I said, so oddly enough, out of all the summer blockbusters that we could have picked or we could have gone back to, we picked an independent film to round out this summer series. I think it's probably going to be one of the most remembered films, even though it wasn't one of the biggest budgeted films. By Richard Linklater, The IMDb description is wonderful because it says the life of a young man, Mason, from 5 to 18. But the beauty of this, the reason that it caught people's eye was because it was filmed over 12 years and there's no real huge events that happen. It's just about boyhood and life happening in the little moments in between huge events. So it's really different. It's probably going to, you know, be something that's a classic for a long time. And to join me, I have my wife. She's awesome. You know her, Laura. With her is a guy that I love having on the show and who I think this movie might secretly really be about, from Houston, oddly enough, Wade Bearden. So we just have a great conversation. We just talk about all the implications of what this movie says about life and how we see it. So a lot of fun. Here it is, episode 34. Boyhood and the Magic of the Mundane. Movie theaters are modern day pulpits. Real World Theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
I haven't seen Snowpiercer yet, but I can actually stream that. It's like, I mean, it's kind of expensive. It's like $6 through Amazon for a rental, but I mean, if you have a couple people there and you were going to go see it at the theater anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the weird thing. I was told that you could rent it through Amazon, and that was one of the reasons that it kind of popped up on the now is the time to review it schedule. But I was like, I don't understand why it would be so expensive to rent a movie. Like, I guess it's because it's new, so they're like charging you like a pseudo ticket price.
Yeah, that's what it did. That's what they do now with certain films. It'll be in theaters, and so because it's in theaters, they say it's kind of like when you go to a hotel room. You know, you can rent movies that are not on DVD yet for more expensive. So I don't know.
See, that's the thing though. I thought that was almost going away because that's like the pay per view more or less thing, right? Like the
yeah. In
that's
a sense.
Pseudo, like, they have it 3 weeks before you can actually rent it on DVD, or you can just pay for the subscription.
Yeah, that's
Well, this is an assumption because it's been so long since we've had legitimate television service that I'm assuming that's how it still works.
Yeah, something like that. I don't have television service either.
I mean, I haven't had that since my boyhood.
What?
Oh
man! But I'm glad you emailed me because I was going to email you after we got out of church just to let you know that hey, things are still going on. Laura has actually asked me more than once this week if I was going to send out any kind of show notes or any what have you. I just like to in general just you know give people like a hey, it's a couple days reminder anyway. I mean, you've been through this before. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But, man, this past week was, you know, Laura's birthday. Woohoo. Mm-hmm. And our anniversary.
Man.
And then we had a Doctor Who marathon all day yesterday, which was super important.
Now, was that with people or was that just y'all?
It was with people.
We were ones who lasted all day.
Yeah, well, we had one other person that and lasted. Our roommate. But yeah, it was like a drop-in, catch a few episodes, and you know, most people don't have the mettle for a true marathon. Yeah. And I understand that, be it their life stage or their, I don't know, their outlook on if it's really necessary.
Yeah.
But, you know, I enjoy it. Laura really enjoys it. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons that we do it, I guess. But it's always nice just to have you have the doors open. You fling them open and you're like, anyone stop by whenever. You have some snacks. People enjoy, you know, lots of people will plan to come by during their favorite episodes or their favorite parts. The same thing happens when we do like Lord of the Rings. Like, not a lot of people come for fellowship. Lots of people like kind of show up in the middle, or they want to show, you know, and they, hey, we came, we watched Two Towers, and we headed out. Or, you know, they come catch the end of Fellowship, they watch Two Towers, and they head out. Or they come at the end of Fellowship, and they watch Return of the King, and then, you know, they're with us till the end. But
which I'm totally fine with, as long as they don't expect some kind of fanfare when they enter and want to have a chat.
Yeah, we're like,
yeah, like I'm
we're watching
this.
A movie.
Be quiet.
Yeah, like, I need you dedicated to this marathon.
You have to be dedicated to the marathon.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I understand people are at different stages in their marathon watching. I mean, it really is kind of, you know, like running a real marathon. Like, it's really tough to sit down and marathon a show all day if you have very little practice sitting on a couch watching a TV show all day.
For 12 hours.
Yeah, so this takes, you know, this
takes
practice.
I don't think I can do it.
I mean, it takes, you know, you have to exercise your visual cortex.
Like, you have to watch all of the Ninja Turtle movies in a row.
That's where, right.
You know, you have to, like, build yourself up.
And then go to the new one?
Yeah, you gotta like, start with small franchises and then, like, work yourself up to something gigantic.
Yeah, like, do the Terminator 1 and then kind of...
Hey, we haven't done that before.
We haven't.
I've done the Terminator, but we always stop. We do the first two. And stop.
Yeah. Well, what I would do now is the same thing we've done with a couple things where I leave out particular ones that I don't think really give any value to the marathon experience.
Yeah.
Actually, we talked about this last time you were on because we didn't marathon necessarily the Planet of the Apes movies.
True. That actually would have been really hard to marathon.
That would have been hard.
Oh,
some of
man.
First
I don't
movies
know if
are
I
pretty
could
slow.
Have done that.
Yeah, some of those first movies are pretty slow. It would have been a rough marathon. But conceptually, you know, we did watch, you know, all the Planet of the Apes movies. We skipped the Tim Burton one because I was like, if I'm wanting Laura to really enjoy the Planet of the Apes movies, I'm not going to put her through this.
Yeah.
And we've had reason to because Laura had a very different childhood than I did. Mm-hmm. It's one of those ways you balance each other out really well. Except now I'm trying to tip the scales for the things I consider that she missed out on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have lots of things. When a new movie comes out, when like Ninja Turtles come out, she's like, oh, I've never seen any Ninja Turtles anything. You know, she knows who they are roughly. You know, she's seen commercials and things like that. She's not oblivious, but she's never actually watched any like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle cartoons or any of the movies. So I'm like, well, I think this is probably going to be a terrible movie, but this is a great time for you to watch these movies that were, you know, instrumental in my boyhood.
Not having watched the movies didn't stop me as a teenager from pretending that I'd watched the movies and picking a favorite anyway.
Man, you know what? I haven't seen any of the Ninja Turtle movies. For some reason, I wasn't allowed to watch them when I was a kid. I don't remember why.
I wasn't either. I'm not really sure.
I don't know why, because you look at it and you're like, what was wrong with that? You know, compared to everything else. And so I wasn't allowed to. And then I just never have an interest. And so when this new movie comes out, people are like, oh, man, I got to go see it for old time's sake. And I'm like, man, this movie looks terrible. Like, it looks ridiculous. Why would anyone see that? And, so yeah, like I don't know. Maybe I need to go back and watch them, but I don't know anything about the Ninja Turtles.
Well, I mean, like I said, I do have that piece that was attached to seeing that as a kid.
So I, rewatching them, I was like, man, I thought I was going to watch these again, and they were going to be really awful, and I was going to, you know, kind of chastise my boyhood self. I could do this all day. For having liked them in the first place. But yeah. I watched them, and I was like, you know what? These really aren't that bad. I mean, like, you know, for a movie about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, mm-hmm. you know, if you take that concept and you know, just, like I said, extract it from this culture, this pop culture infusion, then it does seem like a silly idea. So when you see it, I'm like, yeah, it actually kind of works. The suits weren't that bad. You know, the story was actually more intricate than I thought it was for like a 1990 film or something like that.
Super complicated.
Really? Really?
Well, yeah, it had like, well, not super complicated, it was just more intricate than I thought.
Okay.
Which the new Turtles movie made up for, you know. But that's the thing. So, Laura, I mean, did you, we never really, I guess, I don't know, stopped to digest the films afterwards? I didn't even know if you really liked them.
Do you feel like you missed out on anything?
Well, I'm going to compare it to something that maybe people is going to shock people, but I
don't compare it to Star Wars.
No.
Everybody compares everything to Star Wars. I'm like,
No. I watched Star Wars growing up, so that, yeah. I'm going to compare it to The Goonies. Okay. Because I watched The Goonies when I was, 9 years ago or whatever. I think we watched it first year we were married.
Yeah, you were like 21 or 22.
And I was like, you know, if I'd watched that when I was a kid, it probably would have been awesome, but I could never see that again and be fine.
Interesting. So. The Goonies, I think it was, I didn't see it till I was older. I thought it was pretty fun. But I have a thing.
But is it like a top favorite of yours? Like you would watch it over and over again? Yeah.
No, I think for a lot of people it would be nostalgic. That's why it would be like a top thing for them.
Exactly.
But I like those. I like some of my favorite movies are like Indiana Jones and Star Wars and Back to the Future. Like I have a thing for some of those 80s movies and E.T. So I like it, but it's not like a top pick or anything.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing though. I would still put, you know, some of the Indiana Jones movies as some of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh yeah, of course.
I mean,
I watch those all the time. I love those.
And I was gonna say that I was about to say, well, the Indiana Jones movies hold up, you know, like they
so Star Wars. And
but now I can't tell if that's just my childhood nostalgia, like being biased against a certain film and not another. Because I would say that like the Goonies didn't rock my world. But I feel like if I saw Indiana Jones for the first time as an adult, that I would really like it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah. No, I remember watching like E.T. every once in a while as a kid. And then I sat down and really watched it as an adult. And I was blown away. I thought it was just fantastic. It's just one of those movies that holds up.
Hmm. Well, that's how I can still watch The Last Crusade. And it never gets old to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's Princess Bride for me. I mean, I could watch it over and over and over again.
I think the Princess Bride is transcendent.
It's on a whole different plane of existence. I've never seen E.T., so I'll have to watch that someday.
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Y'all need to go back and watch it. That's just a classic film. I really enjoyed that film.
That's the thing. I didn't like it when I saw it when I was young.
You know, I didn't either. When I was a kid, I remember watching it, and I didn't think it was that great. I don't know if I was scared or I just don't remember. And then I was an adult, and I watched it again. And so I went back, and I watched all of Steven Spielberg's films. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, I started with his TV movie, Duel, and I went, you know, I worked all the way through. And I watched it again, and I thought it was fantastic.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's another one that in my memory, I feel like we weren't allowed to watch. But maybe some of these movies, I just thought that, but it wasn't true. I don't know. Because, like you said, you go back and you're like, why would I not have been allowed to watch that movie? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, it's one of my favorite games like that we get to play when we go back and kind of like the re-education of Laura.
We need to start a new podcast where we do like my reviews after having seen some movie everyone else on the planet has watched.
I've seen websites do that. Like they'll say they'll rewatch films that they've never seen or they haven't seen forever, and they'll talk about them. And it's really cool. Like I saw one, and it was a girl who had never seen Star Wars, and she watched the original trilogy, and it was funny because she. In her review, she was like, yeah, some of this stuff, it seems like it's been done before.
But you're like, yeah.
But for her, it's like, it has because everyone copied Star Wars.
I had a very similar experience. Griffin, who I think you've been on the show with.
Yeah.
He's been on the show a lot. We were sitting down and trying to watch a movie one time, and I was like, oh my gosh, you haven't seen The Usual Suspects? We have to watch The Usual Suspects.
Oh yeah, it's a good one.
Because the first time I saw the movie, like it kind of blew my mind. But the almost everything in The Usual Suspects has been done tons and tons of times.
Yeah, especially the twist at the end.
Yeah, I mean, like, because now movies. The twist at the end of movies is like the twist of the twist of the twist. It's like, you know, it's almost comically twisting at the end of the movies. All is a play on this really great twist that The Usual Suspects did. And so when he finally sat down and watched it, he was like, you know what? I can appreciate this. But he was kind of like, I feel that I've seen so many films since this has come out that I, you know, this isn't hitting me probably the way it hit you when you first saw it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's been done so many times, like it kind of takes some of that.
That'd be like watching him dodge a bullet in The Matrix and being like, seen it. But like when you watch The Matrix the first time, you're like, what just happened?
Yeah. Slow motion action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it was like when, actually I was listening to a podcast recently, I don't remember what it was, but they were talking about how Citizen Kane was like their favorite movie, and one of the problems with Citizen Kane is like it's hard to watch Citizen Kane now and recognize some of the amazing things they did in the movie, because things that they do in that movie, especially cinematically, are so common that you never really think that there was a time that some of the things they do don't exist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it just kind of goes, oh, okay, well, you know, great acting, you know, it's kind of a neat, you know, interesting story, but like it doesn't have that pack. Like you can't be in the theater like decades ago being like, how did they do that, how did they get this shot, that's crazy. Because you know, we're used to being amazed. And
I wonder if, see, I feel like I don't have the repertoire of film, I mean obviously I don't have the repertoire of films that a lot of people have, but I'm kind of wondering if Boyhood will be that way, because it feels like it's groundbreaking. I wonder if like other people are going to do films that span decades, or, you know, they're going to start emulating this, and then people will be like, oh, Boyhood, that's just another one of those.
I don't get it. What was so great about it?
Faux documentary. Yeah. I wonder if we're just amazed because it feels so different.
I'm sure we'll talk more about this. There are so many variables like that went into this film, and it's almost like a miracle that it came out this way. So to think of someone reproducing it, I think it's definitely possible, but I don't think it's going to be as easy as someone might think it would be. I'm sure we'll get into that.
Well, let us jump right into that. I mean, because we have had this very nice little pre-conversation about some of our favorite movies from our boy/girlhoods.
There you go.
We are here to talk about Boyhood. The funny thing about this episode is that this technically is the last episode in the we're trying to do extra movies. Extra movie reviews for the summer reviews. This will be technically the last one. The next one will not be, you know, sadly, a summer series. We've had a lot of fun, and Wade, it's been great to have you on a couple extra times, helping us get through this with all the extra reviews.
Yeah, it's been fun. I was on for Dawn, which was a great film.
That's right.
I was very jealous.
Yeah.
Man, well, I've been able to talk about some really good films on here.
So, the funny thing is, like, probably one of the biggest films of the year, you were on with Captain America. Yeah. One of the most acclaimed films of the summer that was also, you know, a big film, Dawn. And now you're on what lots of people are kind of earmarking as awards fodder.
Here's what you need Oscar to do. Season. Pick a movie you really want to be good and ask me to be on it, and it'll happen. Interstellar.
Yeah, I was about to say, it looks like you're sharing some favoritism here.
What? Yeah. Well, it just so happens.
Don't tell anybody.
Wade's like, yeah, I'll just wait in the wings until the best movie comes along, and then I'll be there.
Yeah, Foxcatcher, you know, yeah. I'll be on some of those.
Well, I was going to say, I think if I'm going to do that, what I would probably do is not have you on a movie like Interstellar, because
it's already going to be good.
Well, right? Yeah, I'm pretty
sure.
Oh,
we hope.
Like, well, that's the thing. I think Interstellar could be terrible, and that's there are true. People who love Christopher Nolan so much, they're going to love it.
I mean,
for the same reason that I have conversations, you know, that, like, I have conversations still about Inception. I'm like, it wasn't as good as you think it was. And people are like, it's the best Christopher Nolan movie that's ever been... It's the best movie that's ever been made. And I'm just like, this is how polarizing it's... Well, you know, it doesn't... I don't really want to harp on whether my opinion of the film is correct or not. But, like, I enjoyed it, but I don't think it's the best movie ever made. But there's... It's
not even the best Christopher Nolan film.
Well, like I said, whether, you know, we think this or not, the point being that it's polarizing.
That's
you know,
true.
People are like, I just, it wasn't as great as people were saying, or people are like, you don't understand, it's the best one. And so I feel like when Interstellar comes out, people are going to be like, this is the worst Christopher Nolan film, he overreached to try to do this, or it's going to be like, you don't understand, Christopher Nolan just blew my mind.
Well, so, I will say that the trailer itself makes me tear up.
Yeah, I mean,
rage against, you know, like the quote, the man. I'm excited about it. I liked I like his films. I think Dark Knight is probably his best one. But
I mean, I like Memento and stuff like that.
Yeah, Memento is pretty great.
I always forget he did that one. I like that one.
But see, okay, so all this to say, I think if I'm going to use your superpower of being on excellent or influential shows, I would actually probably do it on something that I'm afraid is going to be a lot worse than I want it to be. So I'd probably have you for, like, The Hobbit. You can come on and redeem the haters who don't enjoy it at all. But I think that's how I'd probably choose to use your super
awesome
podcasting powers.
Oh, man. I'm nervous because it's The Hobbit. I don't know. I don't have a lot of hope for The Last Hobbit. But we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, like I said, that's why it's, you know, everything you touch turns to excitement, right?
Let's do it.
But, gosh, I don't even remember what it was. Oh, yes, Boyhood. See, this is the best
what
part. This is the best part.
Oh, yeah, that's
part.
What we're talking about today.
This is the best part. Boyhood. So, Boyhood... is a film from Richard Linklater.
Linklater. Yeah.
Wade corrects me. I agree. He's from Texas. Linklater's from Texas.
Linklater.
You get to be the final voice on that one, being fellow Texas person. But he has brought us such films as the Before trilogy, the Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight. One of Laura's personal favorites, School of Rock.
it's so weird, his range. I mean, he has the Before trilogy, he has Boyhood, and he has School of Rock.
Well, and Dazed and Confused.
Bernie?
We love Bernie.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, I was like, oh, I guess we'll just watch some movie, because we kind of like Jack Black sometimes. And I
was
like,
so different.
Yeah, I was like, this movie. Why is this movie so good? Like, it shouldn't have. Like, I felt like I was gonna watch, you know, like a 2.5-star movie just to kill some time because it had Jack Black in it. And all of a sudden, I'm like, what?
Yeah. Hey, did you hear? The real Bernie got out of prison, and Linklater is allowing him to live in like this guest house type deal on his property.
Huh.
So Bernie's out of prison, I guess you could say, living with Linklater. on his property.
To a certain degree.
You could say that, yes.
Yeah, well, you know. But I just thought that was hilarious.
Wow.
Well, I guess the point of that tangent is, if you haven't seen Bernie, we would also highly recommend you see Bernie.
Yeah.
I think all of us would highly recommend. Mm. I mean, and if you like Boyhood, I think you would like Bernie. I think it would kind of be up your alley. But that other thing, I think you also hit on something really great. Way that, I mean, he has his range is really weird. I'm like, he's basically doing these movies that are like the Before series that are supposed to be like, you know, some of the like the best like love movies ever made, especially like in a trilogy over time.
Mm-hmm. Love movies.
Love movies. I don't know.
Like, we don't call those like romances.
Romance movies. I mean, like,
I'm gonna start. I'm like, man. Love hey, let's movies. Go check out the new love movie.
The new love movie
at the cinema this weekend.
I hate it because I don't feel like we get lots of romance movies in general. So I feel like they're almost always romantic comedies.
Yeah, that's true.
Or they're romantic tragedies. You know.
Nicholas Sparks.
Yeah, we get Nicholas Sparks. So I, you know, anyway, so he's done this, but then he, you know, he's done School of Rock, and he has the subtle humor of Bernie. He has the outlandishness, just I don't know, this third party perspective that, you know, Dazed and Confused has. So he does have a pretty wide range, but in this one, which was filmed over 12 years, which is what you're going to hear probably most about from anyone else when they mention Boyhood. I love the synopsis to it. It just said, "The life of a young man, Mason, from 5 to 18."
That's it.
You know, yeah, and that's it, and that's the beauty of it. Let's see, it stars a kid that he had a cast when he was 6 year old, Eller Coltrane. Mm. I'm basically every time I say a name, I'm waiting for Wade to correct me.
That's good. Think of the risk too it took to cast a 6 year old. And to say, like, he could have grown up to be super awkward in front of the camera.
Mm-hmm. Or just completely refused to comply at some point.
And wow, that's one of the miracles of this film, that it just somehow it worked out. And maybe he took acting lessons, but from a very young age, he's really good, and he made it work.
Well, that was one of the things that I read with all the fanfare of the film. It talked about, well, actually, Linklater talked about needing to cast the role and the risk involved. And he said that there were lots of other people who were kind of up for the role that were more actory, you know, a little more polished, a little more like they were ready.
Their parents had them in drama school. And
yeah,
like
you know, things like that. But he said when you cast a 6 year old, you're not really casting them, you're casting their parents.
Wow.
And so he said that Coltrane's parents had like long-standing roots to the Austin area. They weren't going anywhere. They were both artists, and so they kind of understood the process and the vision he was going for, and they were kind of on board with that. So he said that factored in a lot more than like Eller's ability to, you know, actually act. Even though it was there to some degree.
Maybe I'm not giving the actors as much credit as other people are. Credit or blame? I don't know. I felt like the whole nature of the film itself, because I would, like, if I had to characterize it in one word, I would say authentic or authenticity. Like, it felt, it was so relatable because it felt so real. So the nature of the film itself, I think helped with some of that, because if there was a moment that was like awkward, and there were some moments like when he just seemed awkward, or his sister seemed awkward, but I expected that.
But naturally awkward.
Well, I mean, I expected that, because if somebody was filming me living my everyday life, I'm not going to be on all the time, you know? Mm-hmm. I just felt like I expected it to be that way, and so it didn't bother me if something was awkward.
Well, you're talking about expectations and stuff, and I think that, you know, kind of leads us into a natural question, which fortunately is the question that I like to start most of the shows with, even though we've been talking about it, we had expectations going in to a certain degree. I mean, I was told that this movie was amazing. by some people, by Wade, you know, you know, so I was expecting, you know, X, Y, and Z from this movie. But I don't know what you guys were expecting specifically. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, obviously, did you enjoy it? I'm pretty sure that everyone here enjoyed it to some degree. But not only did you enjoy it, but like, how did it, how did those expectations run up against that wall? Like Wade, like, where were your expectations and where did they meet this film?
Well, I didn't read many reviews on the film because I wanted to go in blind. I kind of looked at like what people were saying. Okay, are they saying that this is great or awesome or whatever? And it got a lot of buzz. And so I had very high expectations because people were saying that, you know, this is the best movie of the year so far, maybe the best movie of the year overall, you know, at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And so I came in with very high expectations, but I also knew something that it, you know, it would be really not much of a plot. It would be 3 hours of him growing up. And I went in there expecting that. And there are some movies that'll go in super high expectations. Guardians of the Galaxy, super high expectations. Mm-hmm. A little disappointed, though it wasn't a bad film. But with this one, it met those expectations. And it's weird because I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but there's really no plot per se. There's no explosions. There's not really like this villain. It's just life. And it goes on for almost 3 hours, but yet when I got done, I said to myself, I want to see this again. I want to show my wife this film, and so it really met and in some ways exceeded my expectations, because it was technically a great film, but it captured the essence of growing up, and so I love the film.
All right, how about you, Laura?
I think not only did it capture the essence of growing up, but of life in general. Yeah. I think that's the thing that that had me so stunned after I saw it, because I felt like there was a focus on the boy, I guess, but I was almost more interested in the parents most of the time, specifically his mom. I don't know. I just watching how people faced whatever came at them, you know, what choices they ended up making, what they decided to do with what life threw at them. I don't know. I felt like it really authentically captured what life feels like. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's why people are resonating with it so much, is because they're seeing on screen what they're living every day.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it helped that there wasn't some big, they weren't trying to project it to the to consumers as like something that it wasn't. You know, they weren't trying to say, "Watch Mason as he tries to, you know, he tries to grow up without, you know, a father figure or, you know, whatever." They didn't say anything about like what happened to him. They just said it's just his life. And I mean, there's something about that. I mean, how can they put that out there and then people flock to see it? Was it only because people were saying it was good? I mean, there has to be something.
I think it was the 12 years.
About that.
I think it's the 12 years that got people very
interested.
The nature
of the project. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true. That's what, I mean, that's why I would have seen it no matter what, I think. Just curiosity of what that looks like.
Yeah. And how they pulled it off. And it got great word of mouth. And you're right. It captured the difficulties of parenting, and Patricia Arquette's character, the mom, was fantastic. She could have been very cliche. She could have been, you know, this mom who'd been hurt by these men and kind of self-pity, but she really kind of broke through that, and she was like, hey, we got to keep going. Like, life is moving, and we have to move with it, and her character was very interesting. She really did a great job. I think out of everyone, she was probably my favorite of the cast.
Yeah. She was so dimensional, not being the main character, I guess you could say. I guess we're saying Mason's the main character, right?
Yeah.
It's about him.
Yeah,
it's
not
motherhood.
It's true. It's not motherhood. But she, you know, she was so dimensional and she doesn't even have a name, does she? I mean, I don't remember a name. She was just called Mom all the time.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was actually trying to find before we went to record, because Patricia Arquette's character is billed as Mom. And Ethan Hawke's character is billed as Dad. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, didn't they have a conversation at one point when they were like, or like the grandma says, oh, hey.
Yeah, their names.
It's Mason Sr. is Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke. But I read in a review somewhere Patricia Arquette's character's name, but I don't remember hearing that in the film at all.
Well, she wasn't that to us, the viewer. You know, she was just Mom to us, the viewer, I guess is what we're discovering.
Yeah, because for the most part, except for only one scene that I can remember, I'm not saying there's only one scene, but there's only one scene that I can remember where we were really taken away from something that could have been Mason's point of view. And that was when Dad, at Mason's graduation, went and talked to Mom.
Mm, right.
Yeah.
And I thought he said, hey, so-and-so, mm-hmm. you know...
Yeah,
you've done a great job, you know, raising the kid. I just wanted to say that. But maybe they just had that awkward conversation, like most people do in real life. I never typically walk into say, hey, name of person that I'm talking to.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of usually have that, hey, so.
Yeah.
You know, you meander in a conversation.
Yeah, no.
But other than that, I can't remember many points of view that were. That even if Mason wasn't directly involved with, he was like not in the room for, or not, you know, generally around for. So I thought that was pretty cool too, because it does give us a very unique point of view in this film. I mean, that was one of the things that I'll probably go into detail more, but lots of the things that we see happening in his life, we have to assume or infer because we only get his point of view on it. We don't see the relationships of his mother and father play out, so we don't know how they get to the states they get to. But I mean, like, when it comes to like enjoying this movie, I did enjoy it, because even though I wanted parts of this movie, I wanted there to be like some type of event, because I wanted there to be like a I guess like a some narrative theme to follow, or
where it like comes to fruition in one moment.
This is the middle and this is the end. And I realize that most movies do that, and we're kind of trained to have most movies do that, and so I wasn't 100% disappointed that it didn't like resolve, or it didn't have a main conflict. That was there is you know, the conflict of, you know, boy versus himself just trying to grow up. And these little non-super him interpersonal relationships, but there's a conflict. It's like you said, and when you wrote your review on this, you know, the CIA doesn't come knocking on your door in your normal everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, often, you know, sometimes, but not maybe often.
Every once in a while.
You know.
That's it.
And so, you know, that's what we get. So I was a little, when the film ended, I was like, I want more, and I want him. I want something to resolve itself. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing: life doesn't typically resolve itself.
Well, and are you done?
Yeah, I'm done enough.
I don't want to like break into
your... whatever.
Okay, but the interesting thing.
I'm sorry.
Can
I just say one more thing?
No.
No. Go ahead.
Can I? Yep. One more thing.
After like hearing you describe what you were looking for, I realized that. That is the traditional way that, like, filmmaking or storytelling would present that to you. Like, this is the theme, and, you know, here's it all tying together. And I think there actually are those moments. Because if we could disagree on this, but I would say that most, I'll just say for me, that the point of the film, if there was one central theme, would have been in what Mason says at the very, very end about... Yeah. Life happening in every moment. So if you think about that being the central idea, then if you hit, you know, come back a little bit, there's a conversation that he has with his dad, which is not some, you know, amazing, grandiose moment or event, but he has this conversation with his dad asking him basically, like, help me out here. You know, he's talking about his breakup with his girlfriend and saying, like, what's it all for? What's life for? And then if you come back a little further from that, I think it happens before that is the conversation he has with his mom where she breaks down when he's leaving her apartment, saying, you know, I just, you know, is this all life is? I thought it would be better, she says. Mm-hmm. I just thought it would have been better. So I think it is, like, strung through the movie, that there are moments where it kind of draws your attention back to characters wrestling with what is the point of life? Like, I have these questions. What are the answers? So, yeah, it wasn't like some building blowing up, but those, like, those centralizing or, like, you know, pulling together moments were happening.
Yeah, and I felt like that was kind of the big idea, that there is magic in the mundane, and life isn't all these, you know, big moments. It's a collection of small moments, and those are the things that change our lives. And one of my favorite scenes is when after Mason graduates, they're sitting down to eat with the mom and Mason and his sister, and the young man who's their waiter comes up and he says that the mom, you know, she had years ago met him and he was working on a pipe in their yard, and she said, "You're a smart guy, you should go to college," just in passing, and completely forgets about that. And he comes back and he says, "You know, what you said to me changed my life." And that, for me, kind of just encapsulates the entire film, that in the small moments, that's where life happens. It happens in the everyday conversations. And with Mason, you're not getting, you know, a lot of big stuff. And even when back when he was a kid and he's in the car with his stepdad who's drunk, and you think they're going to get in an accident, and they don't get in an accident. Mm-hmm. There's none of that big stuff happening, because he's really trying to communicate, hey, it's the mundane things. This is where life is happening. And so I think there are a lot of themes that we can identify, but I think that's kind of Linklater's big idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the further and further I get away from seeing the movie, the more and more I realize that every time I try to critique the movie, it kind of comes back to me and says, I'm still winning. And I'm like, what?
Right.
Yeah. Because like, I really didn't like the first time I saw it, when he basically, at the very end of the film, when, you know, he eats what we're assuming is the tainted brownie or cookie or whatever.
Something.
And then he goes and has, you know, he sits out in the middle of the desert and says this completely, what I think is dumb, you know, like, hey, what if the moments are like moments, man?
Yeah, but you that's know, such like a freshman in college way of seeing
exactly
something that's actually profound.
So I want to criticize the movie from like, gosh, that's so dumb. But then I'm like, wait. So what this movie's really doing is pointing out that all the conversations that I had when I was in college that I thought were so profound are the same conversations that this kid's having. And I'm like, you win again, boyhood. Just when I thought I could critique you for something that I thought was, you know, inane or, you know, a misstep, I'm like, wait, you're really just showing, like, this is what happened when I got to college. And I was like, I'm out of the house now. I'm figuring things out for my, you know, for myself. Man, I know what life's about. It's about the thing, man. You know,
it's about the moment.
It's like what Orson Scott Card said about people criticizing the way the kids talk in Ender's Game. And he said, kids don't sound like kids to themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and this book is from Ender's point, all the kids' point of view. And yes, they're geniuses. But, you know, when a kid is saying something, they feel like they are the smartest person in the room. You know, we all talk that way. At this stage in life, we are the smartest person we know.
Well, I am the smartest person I know.
Obviously.
Yes, obviously.
Actually, yeah. And something I want to mention before I forget about it is you said the phrase, there's Wade, that there's magic in the mundane. Mm-hmm. And that reminded me of a scene in which they say that exact thing without saying those words, which is when Mason Jr. is asking Mason Sr. if there are elves.
Yeah.
And his dad describes just the wonder of a whale that does exist, you know, in our world. And he described it so beautifully, and so he just does such a great job of showing the magic in what a whale is. And then Mason just says, "So you're saying there's no elves?"
Yeah, no, Lord, that's a great example. And he's like, you know, he's thinking the magic is trolls and elves and all these little things. And he's like, magic is our world. Look at our world. And it, man, it's just the perfect illustration for the entire movie. You know, magic is, you know, saving the day or being a superhero. You know what magic is? Your conversations with your parents, your conversations with your friends.
Or the guy fixing the pipe in your yard.
The guy fixing your, yeah, the Houston Astros game. Like those, that's where the magic happens. And yeah, it's a great illustration.
Well, I think, I mean, I think it's a great reminder for us to not waste any moments. You know, I feel like we're always waiting for like, oh, I've just got to, one of my biggest pet peeves is anyone who like throws down a TGIF or, you know, like waiting for the weekend or, you know, you got a case of the Mondays, you know, things like that. I just feel like you are wishing your life away.
Oh yeah.
You're waiting for this day that's going to make up for all this time that you're missing, when all this time that you're missing or you're letting pass is probably has more potential to enrich you and satisfy you, or even intrigue you or just captivate you compared to this one event that you're waiting for, like on Saturday night, which, you know, I think is what the film typically shows. I mean, that's where all the stuff happens. And that's where I really was on board with what the film did, because I didn't necessarily care about Mason's journey as much as some people have. But again, you know, I want to kind of criticize that and be like, I wasn't really on Mason's journey. But what this did was this made me think about my own boyhood. And I was like, gosh, how many things did I do that probably shaped me more than the milestone moments that most people would point to? You know, like, hey, what have you done in your life? Oh, I got this job. You know, I got a car at this age. My parents divorced at this time. And most of those specific events didn't really change who I was. It was, you know, like late night conversation. I remember a conversation where I walked for like 3 hours one night with a friend on a beach. And there wasn't anything special. We didn't figure anything out. We just talked and walked. And that, for some reason, impacted me. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, conversations have power. Listening into someone's story has power. But like I said, we didn't figure out the keys to the universe. You know, we didn't, you know, we didn't do anything like that. We didn't find any of the stones to the Infinity Gauntlet. Nothing super exciting.
Well, that's basically what, if I wish I had that conversation in front of me that he had with his dad, like at that bar. But I feel like that's kind of what he was saying, was that, you know, we're looking for those moments that give us answers, you know, that like we're waiting for this to reach this pinnacle where all these questions we have are going to, we're just going to find answers for, and the mystery will be gone. But the point is that the point is the mystery, you know, living into the mystery and enjoying it while you're there, which I think could be a debatable, like from a, if we talk theology, could be a debatable theme, you know? I mean, does that mean that this is all we have? You know, whatever. But I think there is something to be said of being able to rest in mystery, you know, that there are bigger hands than ours.
Yeah.
So, and I was just thinking about that when you were talking about that conversation. You said you didn't figure out life, but there was still something powerful about it. You know, the fact that there was still mystery there. There was still things that you struggled with coming out of that conversation that you went into, you know, that didn't matter. The conversation still mattered.
Yeah, and I wrote about this in my article, but for me, it just made me realize some of the most fantastic moments in my life, like you said, Fizz, are some of the moments that you don't really think about. And for the film, this film hit me hard when Mason goes with his dad and his sister to the Houston Astros game. So I live in Houston, and you know, I see the skyscrapers, and they go. I think it was Enron Field at the time. It's Minute Maid Park now, and they watch the Houston Astros. And Roger Clemens is on the mound, and then Nathan Lane This obscure Houston Astros player that nobody knows. He hits a three-run home run, and it just reminded me of one specific game where my dad took me to Roger Clemens' first start as a Houston Astro, and it was just a normal game. I mean, we used to go to Astros games all the time, but now my dad's experiencing these health problems, and you look back at those moments that seem small, and they are very powerful now, and this film really is pushing me, and it's still pushing me to live in the moment. That if I'm talking to someone who's working in my yard, or I'm talking to someone at the store, like, I have an opportunity to do something big in that small moment, or with my family, or with my son, with my wife. And so I believe that this film, of course, is not written or directed from the Christian perspective, but I do think that it teaches us, hey, that this life matters, and mm-hmm. make the most of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is something I want to say that we talked about when we talked about Edge of Tomorrow, because we're talking about time travel and, you know, like, why we're here, the things that are kind of like you would redo or things like that. And we ended up talking about when people, like, lots of people look forward to the next life as Christians. They're like, okay, I can't wait till I get to heaven. I can't wait till I get to heaven. I can't wait till I get to heaven. And it's actually pretty depressing to me. Not heaven, but, like, wishing away your life. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this concept that, I remember hearing it, probably 10 or 15 years ago in a sermon that I don't even remember who said it. But obviously it's impacted me. It's like the
mundane, right?
Yeah, the mundane. So in whatever, whoever said this sermon at whatever time it was, this little line that was probably just a throwaway line in their sermon, they probably didn't even have it written down. What was, this concept of if we weren't meant to do anything else, then when we accepted Christ, we would have instantly died and been whisked away to mm-hmm. heaven. If that was the only point. Mm-hmm. Was to say, say yes, you believe in something. But since that doesn't happen, we have to assume that we're still here for something. Mm-hmm. There's a purpose for us to still be here. And I feel like people want that purpose to be called upon by the CIA, or, to do something crazy, or mm-hmm. to be like, I am still here because I am going to achieve this huge thing. But I also believe that we're made for community. And sometimes I believe just being there in a moment for someone else is a beautiful thing. And it's more powerful than, I don't want to say saving the earth to a certain degree, but like mm-hmm. Doing some kind of action hero, or what you would typically see in a movie, like the resolution of the family, the whatever, like just being a shoulder for someone when they had a bad day, or heck, just being able to, like, walk by yourself outside and enjoy nature mm-hmm. away from technology for 3 seconds. Obviously not right now, because you should totally be listening to this podcast. It's what God would want you to do.
Or take it with you on a walk.
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, like I said, it's just this concept that, like, by wishing away or skipping parts of your life, I feel like you are missing something. And even though, like you said, this wasn't probably written with lots of Christian theology in mind, I don't think it's anti-Christian to say that we should be endeavoring to make the most of every single moment that we're still here.
No. And as Christians, sometimes we can live by escapist theology. We're thinking about our escape. But in Revelation, it talks about how the new heavens and new earth, it's coming down, and God created this world, and it's good, and he's going to set it to rights one day, and we can start that process now. And that means living in the moment. That means taking care of our planet, taking care of the environment, helping others. And I don't necessarily, we don't have the answer as to, okay, how does planting a tree help God as he's going to recreate this earth or this or that? We don't know, but we know we're starting the process now, and we can use every moment to bring heaven right down on earth. Your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And we have to use an opportunity to do that. And changing our world, we think we need a huge stage, but it might just be one or two people that we impact. And that's important to remember.
Well, that's the whole point, I think, is that we don't know what is important and what's not. I mean, we have a system of values that we've put in place. We have this vocabulary that we use to describe what's important, what's valuable, and what's not.
It's dollar amount.
Yeah. But we don't really know what the most, you know, what true value is. I mean, who knows what God counts? Well, I think we do know through the scriptures to some degree, but, you know, what God counts as most holy or most valuable or most precious, you know, I think is probably much further away from what we think is valuable than we dare to, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel like I fight this a lot as a trying to live as a full-time artist, this, you know, concept of value and what is valuable and what's not. I mean, I wish that as Christians we had a different vocabulary for value, but I think that we all talk about things in terms of monetary value and, you know, dollar amount.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I want to believe that that creating something that only I see is still important, is still value, you know, writing a story that nobody ever sees, writing a poem nobody ever sees, taking a walk and seeing something that nobody else experiences, all that is still has value.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is precedence for that in the scripture, but somehow we are really, really far away from that and not even trying to get back. For the most part, I think this is something that people seem to rarely talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when people typically try to get me on board with nearly any idea, they almost always begin by telling me of the monetary reward mm-hmm. for being mm-hmm. on board with some idea. And I'm like, it's not how I make decisions most of the time.
Yeah.
But still, it is still tempting. You know, that's the thing that frustrates me about myself is that people will, they're not trying to be, you know, mean, but people will say things to me when I talk about what I do for work that makes it sound like they think that I'm sitting around doing nothing, you know, or that if I don't have anything published that my time is not being spent wisely. Mm-hmm. And I hate that, and it makes me angry at people, but at the same time, half the time I'm sitting at home saying, I need to apply for jobs. This is worthless. This has no value because I'm not bringing in money. So I feel that myself while I'm still being angry at people for projecting that on me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't break away from it. I mean, it's hard to break away from this idea that really that value can be quantified, you know, and for us, it's the dollar amount most of the time, you know, or power, people's praise.
Well, that's what it seems like what Coltrane is really dealing with in the film. He wants to be a photographer and he feels like his life is being controlled by this or that. And notice when he visits his mom while she's a student. The professor who would be a stepdad is talking about Pavlov's dogs and his experiment, right? So they train the dogs to salivate when a bell is rung. And then later on, his mom is teaching, and he's talking about Skinner's box, and it's experiment they can use to control certain animals. And I think there's this theme of control, and he's trying to break free from this control, and he wants to produce art. And he's struggling with, okay, we're wasting our lives on technology. What's the meaning of life? What's the point? And I think that's something that we can relate to because it's something I relate to. Like, what is it just, okay, live, get a job, die, you know, and everything, the process is repeated over the centuries. And so he's dealing with that too. And that's the honest part of this movie is he's trying to figure out his way. He's trying to be on his own, while at the same time he's still connected to his past and to his family.
Yeah, there's definitely a piece of it where he's trying to figure out how much he wants to be influenced by the people around him,
mm-hmm.
and how much he wants to set his own, you know, set his own way.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm. and sometimes, and he tries a lot of things, you know. Sometimes he breaks the rules and gets drunk, and and sometimes, you know, sometimes he does what his parents want him to do. Mm-hmm. I don't know. He's trying different ways, I think.
It's not necessarily a black and white type of film. Like, so I was thinking about Ethan Hawke's character. Is he a good dad or is he a bad dad? Well, I mean, at the start, he's kind of a bad dad. I mean, he leaves his family, but then he's good, and some of the advice he gives is really great, and some of the advice he gives is bad, and there's a complexity there. Is Coltrane's character Mason, is he good? Yeah, I think he is, but there's some things that he's dealing with, and I think it illustrates the complexity of life, that for a lot of people it's not necessarily just black and white. There, being a parent is hard, and there are a lot of things going on in this film, and I think that's one of the reasons why I appreciate it so much.
Well, I think that's one of the hardest things. Like, if you take a step back from the film, there's lots of things that we assume about, especially mom and dad.
Yeah.
But we don't get to see their full stories. We only get a glimpse. And to me, it reminded me so much of how we, you know, we look at other people with, you know, we'll say a random person that I don't know may have some road rage issues.
Just hypothetically speaking.
Hypothetically. I've heard about such people. You know, and so you get really mad at someone who cuts you off. And you're like, I assume that this person is Satan. You know? And you have no idea.
There's no redeeming quality about this.
Yeah, exactly. You have no reason why they're there, why they would cut you off, what has led them to think that cutting you off is acceptable, you know, like what their day is like, anything. And it's about dehumanizing a human being.
We judge them. If it's a teenager, we're like, oh man, that teenager. If it's
someone
with a nice BMW, we're like, oh, they have a nice car. They think they own the road, right?
We make all these pre-judgments.
It doesn't matter who it is.
Yeah. I mean, but they do. They do think they do own the road.
I mean, it is true, but yes.
It's obviously true, but other people probably judge that incorrectly.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, that's the thing, because I believe when we left, Laura and I were having a conversation about Patricia Arquette's character. Like, does she just have a type, you know? Or why wouldn't she have stayed with Mason's dad? Why would she not have stayed with Ethan Hawke's character the whole time? But we don't get to see any of their relationship.
We see it through the window, right? And that's a great picture. It's the kid's perspective watching it from the outside.
Yeah. So Laura's like, well, he wasn't an alcoholic, so why didn't she just stay with him? And I'm like, well, do we know that? They never talk about why they split up. They just said they weren't right for each other, you know? And I'm assuming that, like I said, this is an assumption, that he probably wasn't an alcoholic, or at least an abusive alcoholic, or they probably wouldn't have any relationship whatsoever. But obviously there was something terrible enough for them not to even, you know, like, there's nothing in the film that makes me think, oh, I still kind of wish I was with him, or I kind of still wish I was with her. Mm-hmm. Like, that never comes back up.
Yeah,
at least from the perspective that we're shown.
Yeah,
I mean, even then, like I said, you still have to ask: does she have a type? You know, what circumstances led these guys, who, from you know, Mason's perspective, were perfectly nice guys or impressive, academic. They had cool stories, mm-hmm. but as soon as, like, how did they? What happens as soon as they get married? That suddenly, it, you know, explodes their alcoholism. And I don't want to say that, because there's any hint that we think, you know, Patricia Arquette's character deserved this or anything like that. I think hopefully that's understood. But, you know, because no one deserves that. But what happened? Like, what were those gaps? Like, to say, does she have a type, or do things keep happening out of her control? Or she just have bad taste in men? You know, how you asked earlier, one of you asked, you know, do we think Ethan Hawke was a good dad or not? And we're kind of like, he seems like it? Or he wasn't at first, but then he was? You know, it reminds me of my dad, because I felt like I was born when my parents were very young. And I think being parents for them wasn't something that they were ready to do. But it wasn't until my parents got divorced and I saw, like, my dad get remarried that he seemed really interested in being a dad. And I was like, oh. I mean, you know, like, and that, and like, when I say that, I don't mean that, like, you know, there was zero interest there before or there was zero concern. But, you know, when you don't get to live, like, parts of your life, you know, you don't get to go through the progressions that most people do, you know, like, boyhood to, like, trying to figure out who you are before you're responsible for other people. I mean, it happens every day. You know, we have a huge issue with people who don't even get to come back around and have a father, even like I do. Like, there's people who just never know their fathers and have to grow up and figure all this out on their own. So it's, you know, it's not like a condemnation of my dad, but it's just an interesting scenario. Like, if you would have met him at different stages in his life, then you would say, yeah.
It seems pretty obvious that Mason Sr. cleaned up over the years. I mean, like, basically what you're saying, that he already had children, but it wasn't until much later. I mean, he had another child.
He had a whole
other family, yeah. And it seemed to be very responsible and stable, and, yeah. You know, so he was a dynamic character.
Mm-hmm. And he seemed like he drove and visited every other weekend, too. And it's kind of interesting how we see that. He's there half the time, and so we only see him every 2 years in the film, and it's kind of symbolic of him only being there every other weekend. He's there, but we see the mom every year, I believe, because she's a constant in Mason's life.
I mean, and speaking of his dad, it might have just been me, but the first time I saw Ethan Hawke roll up in that car, I was like, I expected him to get out and give me some kind of life advice, kind of like Ricky Bobby's dad from Talladega Nights. I expected him to just lean over and be like, "Son, if you're not first, you're last." You know, God, he had that mojo going on. Maybe that's a Texas thing. Wade, is that a Texas thing?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know. But you know, I was really pleasantly surprised. There have been some really good films about growing up that have been based in Texas. Tree of Life, which is a fantastic film, is based in Texas. And then you have Boyhood, which is based in Texas, you know, Austin area, San Marcos, in Houston. And I thought that was interesting. And you can almost compare Boyhood to Tree of Life, though Malick is all about the visuals. And Linklater, he's just about the conversations. He's all about the content. But I thought that was interesting, and both of those films are about growing up, and they're both set in the Texas, you know, in Texas.
Maybe we're not giving Texas a fair shake.
Maybe people from Austin or something, like
they're different.
Like I said, there's
people
there's
from like San Antonio or Dallas.
Lots of different opinions on. I hear the people from Houston are incredibly despicable people.
They're terrible. it's the humidity. It just changes. It changes a person.
It changes people. Their like structure, molecular.
Well, let's move to. I mean, it sounds like I said, we all really got a lot from the film. It has made us think while we're watching it a lot since we've watched it. And anytime there's a movie that you really enjoy or really gets you going, it's kind of hard to think of moments that are kind of like, come on. Or, you know, that didn't really work for you. So, were there any of those moments for you, Wade, in this film?
I thought that some of the secondary characters, they weren't the best actors. And for some of them, it was a little... It wasn't necessarily natural. It seemed forced. And so there were a couple times when... I think it was when he was with his friends in that, like, abandoned house where... Just
that was pretty bad.
Yeah, the acting wasn't all that great. It just seemed a little forced. So I would say, out of everything, that's probably the thing that I was like, come on. Coltrane, he didn't have a huge presence in front of the camera, but that the film didn't need that, and it worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if you had somebody who was just dynamic, it would have changed the film, and the film is about the mundane, right? And so, but there were some actors... who just the acting, you know, wasn't what it could be. It was a little forced. So I would say that was the big thing for me, the come on moment.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, and you have a movie that's filled with people who aren't actually actors.
Yeah.
Or, well, I don't want to say they're not actors. That's, I mean, lots of them are probably very, you know, I mean, if you go look up the IMDb page for most of these people that are in this film, they've done this or this and little else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's probably a reason for it. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, I think the pastor in that little country church scene, I think he is just a pastor. But he did, I mean, he did well. But there were some of the other characters that felt a little forced.
Mm. So, Laura, where did you land on this one?
I don't know. I have a really hard time thinking of anything because I think I have a lot of forgiveness for the movie. Because I could totally nitpick and say, I completely forgotten about that scene, Wade. But when I was watching that scene, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Painful, yeah. Acting.
That kid's, he's drinking a beer and he's like, oh, come on, you know. And he's like cussing at them, but it's like, I just didn't feel it.
But at the same time, even when I think back on that scene and how awkward the cussing was and stuff, I just remember how it felt to cuss from the first time, and like you feel so cool, but you sound so dumb, and it just feels so accurate. Everything felt so accurate.
That's a very good point.
You mean hypothetically, not you cussing?
Oh, yeah.
You still never cussed.
Never.
So I just have a lot of forgiveness for the film. It didn't. It did not try to be polished, and so I didn't expect that from it or from any part of it. Really, I mean. I just thought it did what it meant to do really well. So there may have been some scenes that if I really think about it, I could say, oh, yeah, that actor wasn't so good. But, I mean, I think both of you have hit on this about Coltrane, but wasn't there was like something from the internet that we watched, Mikey.
Something from the interwebs.
That one thing from the internet.
That one thing in the internet we watched.
But
that
when
time.
They were talking about the hero basically being like an empty person because the audience is supposed to put themselves in the hero's place. And so, you know, they were like analyzing Luke Skywalker and realizing that he's really not that dimensional. But it works because...
The everyman.
Yeah, yeah. Because you... And I think Coltrane did that.
Very internal performance.
Right, and you even said, Wade, if he had more of a presence, then we probably wouldn't have been able to identify as well as we had with all the moments that he was. I mean, if he was more
charismatic,
more maybe like I'm envisioning that he was more of like a sketch of a person instead of like a painting of a person, if that makes sense. And if he, you know, being a woman watching this movie called Boyhood, if he'd been more than what he was, then it would have been harder for me to put myself in his shoes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I didn't begrudge anything that he did as an actor in this film because I was there the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing, if I had to say a come on moment, there was one moment in the theater where I said, I think I'm getting bored. And I think it may have been in that stint when he was like in high school dating that girl and they were having those conversations.
Okay. Yeah.
I think I wasn't totally into that part, but like I said, when I think back on the scenes, I don't necessarily say, you know, oh, that could have been taken out and the movie would have been fine. Like, I like it how it is. So,
yeah,
you know, I'm not gonna...
Well, I think that's what we've hit on a couple times already. I think the strength of the film is that it answers its own criticism because, you know, the allegedly poor acting in, you know, a scene or two, like, you know, have like cringeworthy scenes where like high schoolers are cussing. I mean, I remember making fun of my brother all the time. Because my brother, when he started cussing, he liked to cuss all the time. But he was legitimately a bad cusser. Like, it just didn't make...
Are you listening to this, Brian?
Yeah, I was gonna say, it just didn't make sense. It's like he was using cuss words, but, like, they didn't make sense where he was using them.
He was like, learning.
Yeah, and so I was like, oh, just stop. Just stop. You know, this isn't natural. Like, this isn't... Like, I don't understand what you're trying to do here except for say these words. And it was just, it was really uncomfortable, listening to him swear, not because of his, you know, word choice, but his lack of understanding of what he was doing at certain times. And, I mean, and I will report that he is much better at swearing now.
He's learned.
He's learned. No. He is really
lots of practice.
But like I said, this is how the movie answers for itself, because anytime that it gives you something to critique, usually the critique, and because when I was thinking of my come on moments, I was like, man, you know, sometimes the, you know, Mason just meandering through life at times, or people criticizing him for being like indecisive, I was like, yeah, I wish he was more decisive. But, you know, like I said, the film answers its own criticism.
That's right. That's what my sister didn't like about it.
Yeah. I was
like, she didn't like him.
Yeah. I was like, if he was any more decisive, or he was like, you know, a man of action or whatever, then it wouldn't have had the, you know, the point that the film did. So when I had to pick a moment that was annoying, I think it's straddling the line of like least favorite and possibly favorite moment. To transition us was when for his birthday in Texas he got a Bible, a stamp, and a gun. And so,
how accurate is this, Wade? Did you get a Bible, suit, and a gun for your birthday?
I was livid.
Yeah. So, my dad's a police officer, and he had a ton of guns, but we never were like hunters. But I know a ton of people who got guns. But I can tell you, I have gotten multiple gifts of Bibles that were engraved with my name on it, and suits. And Ethan Hawke says, "Hey," when he opens it, he goes, "Hey, you're gonna need it. You're gonna need it." That happened to me on my birthday. My parents, they gave me a suit. I remember a black suit, and they're like, you're gonna need this. You're gonna need this. And I was just like, this is it. Like, this is my birthday right here.
This is the thing. Basically, reading like your story about your Astros trip and like the presents you've gotten, I'm pretty sure that maybe Linklater was like following you around for a couple of years.
And the fact that Mason is indecisive, I'm like, that's me.
It's your life.
You're like, that is me. Or is it? I don't know.
Or is it?
I feel a lawsuit coming on.
Yes, for real.
But, okay, so like I said, that one straddles the line for me because...
Wait, you said it was your come on moment?
Well, that's the thing. It straddles the line between come on and, like, favorite because on the one hand, I'm like, come on. No one does that. And then I'm like, this is my favorite moment because it backs up all of my stereotypes of people in Texas. So I don't know whether
there are stereotypes like, loathe it for a reason.
It. Yeah, loathe it or love it. I can't decide. So it gets to be my line straddling for the first time ever on the podcast. It is both my least favorite and favorite moment. Least favorite because this should never ever happen in real life.
I felt so uncomfortable when he got that Bible. I was like, this kid hates this gift.
Oh man, I have multiple Bibles with my name on it. I do.
I remember getting them all the time. Yeah, even though I did not grow up in Texas, it's the Bible Belt, man. And people are like, what greater gift can I give?
It's true.
You know. Than the forcing something God. Uncomfortable, on, yeah, forcing something uncomfortable on you, and guilting you with it,
yeah,
just like Jesus would.
Yeah,
so okay, so wait, what was your? I mean, I know you've talked about a whole bunch of favorite scenes and stuff, but what was your favorite thing?
Oh man, okay, so it would have to be the Houston Astros game. I mentioned that already, and then I mentioned the waiter who approaches the mom and says, "Hey, you changed my life." So those are my favorite moments. What I guess my other favorite, if you know, to add to that, were all the pop culture references and how Linklater uses that to add humor. Whether it's the YouTube video or you know, them watching Dragon Ball Z or the Razer cell phone, you know, all those different things. It just reminded me of growing up, and it's so fascinating because he uses these pop culture references that are happening right then, but they totally work out now. It's hilarious. And it's funny because Coltrane Mason, they're talking about the president, and he says, "Who do you think should be president?" He's like, "Rick," you know, he says, "Perry, Rick Perry." Well, then nobody knew who Rick Perry was, but now it's funny. And then Star Wars, they're like, you know, you can't do anything after Return of the Jedi.
Will they ever make another one?
Yeah. And it tapered off towards the end because we start getting closer. But
so we don't know what we can make fun of.
Yeah. So I thought those were really well done. For me, it's very close to a perfect movie, and I don't say that a lot. But it's hard, like we talked about, it's hard to say, you know, what's the fault. There are a couple things, but it's pretty close to a perfect movie for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It is just like its own little vortex of like, it keeps like turning negatives positive and positive negatives.
There you go.
It's its own plane. I think the whale part was one of my favorite moments when he, because I was right there with Mason Sr. when he was, I mean, just the way that those lines were written, where he says, well, if somebody told you that there was an animal that was like this big, you know, like, would you believe it? And it made me think about how many magical things are in the world that I don't think of as, you know, as beautiful. I just dismiss them. I love that moment.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
And how, you know, it wasn't cheesy because Mason Jr. just brought it back down again. Like,
yeah.
So you're saying there's no elves. And then my other favorite moment was when Mason was leaving his mom's apartment and she just pretty much had a breakdown. I just really felt what Arquette was doing right there. I mean, I have felt that way maybe because it's one of the more recent life stages I've been through where I just think, you know, I've done all this stuff and now I'm here and what's next? I don't know what's next and what's the point of anything? And, you know, just kind of mourning a loss, mourning the passing of a life stage and wanting there to be a reason for things, wanting there to be meaning and, you know, I just was right there with her. So, those are probably my two favorite. I really liked the dad a lot. I thought Ethan Hawke did a great job. And I liked him because he was a mess. But he probably apologized more than any character in the movie. I mean, like, he would say something to his kids. Even the bumper thing. Later, he just said, I'm sorry about the bumper thing, dude.
Yeah.
Like, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
I just think he's so... so much what I want to be, you know, I want to like live large and be brave and be able to apologize when I, you know, bump people wrong along the way.
Well, like I said, I have the line straddling moment, but I did like the scene that Laura mentioned when, you know, Mason's dad is talking about like magic in the everyday. I think that's when I realized, like, that his character was deeper than what I imagined. Because that would have been the perfect time for him to turn, like I said, into Ricky Bobby's dad and be like, you need to go fast. Just go fast. so it was that. And even though I didn't, you know, obviously love the cons or what was happening in the scenes, being able to capture some of the scenes, the uncomfortableness of, like, the angry, drunk stepfather stuff. Like, I don't know. Like, there were people who jumped. Probably Laura was one of them.
I was definitely one of them.
You know, when he threw, like, the glass or whatever. Like, at his the stepdad threw a glass at his own kid.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then told him, I was just like, wow. Like, I was like, this movie just got, you know, intense.
It just got real.
Yeah. And even though, you know, obviously, you know, wasn't a huge fan of what was happening in the scenes, like just being able to capture that. Mm-hmm. I think so many times that becomes almost funny or over the top, and it was neither of those things. And I think that was a really hard thing to capture with the right tone. Mm-hmm. And so, it, like I said, it speaks volumes of just like I said, what Linklater was able to do in this film. So, with that, final thoughts, Wade. Final thoughts.
No, I mean, if for people who are listening, if you have a chance, definitely go see this film. It's, I mean, I loved it. I of course I haven't seen all the films that are going to come out this year. If I had to guess, I would say it'll probably be one of my favorites. It's my favorite so far. So I would say go get an opportunity to go see it. Maybe take a short road trip or something. It's very, very good, and it's worth your time.
All right.
I think I'm just really impressed by Linklater's, just his patience with this project, like his willingness to put that much time and effort and resources into this project. Mm-hmm. I just really respect that as an artist. It just feels like something new and fresh, and it also feels like it's trying to get at something really true, you know, trying to do something for art's sake, but make it really good, you know, like not make it something no one can understand. But anyway, I just really respect him as an artist, and I'm excited to watch the Before trilogy because it's interesting to me that he seems fascinated by showing like lives fully lived over mm-hmm. a span of time, mm-hmm. which I think is so cool because, I mean, the human life is just such an amazing thing. There's so much to be told in every moment. And so, and I think that we maybe focus too much on those big things, getting, you know, mining something out of the big moments. But mm-hmm. so I'm excited to see what he did with those three films. That sounds interesting. And like the 9-year gaps.
Yeah, I think there are going to be some conspiracy theorists because Ethan Hawke looks a lot like Coltrane. At the end, he's got the slick back hair and the mustache and the goatee. And in Before Sunrise, he says that his parents are divorced and that he has a sister. And I was reminded of that, and I was just like, conspiracy theory right here. And I think Linklater made a joke about that. He said, they said, are you going to make a sequel? And he said, well, you know, maybe one day Mason gets on a train to Europe and he meets a French girl. And conspiracy theory maybe that right can there.
Happen. Wow, there that's go. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think, I don't know if he had that in mind, but it's interesting to say the least.
Well, I was going to say, all we have to do maybe is look back. When did Before Sunrise come out?
95, I believe.
Okay, so it came out before he actually started this project.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, I would say that this movie is definitely worth your time. If you're listening to this, you probably have already seen it, but hopefully...
Oh, that's true, that's true.
I mean, hopefully... We've talked about some things that maybe have put words to some of the things that you were feeling during this movie.
Or changed your mind about some things.
Yeah, or maybe change or let the movie change your mind by defending itself.
You got pulled into the vortex.
I would highly recommend this movie mm-hmm. to most people. I mean, like, you know, there are some people who don't enjoy indie movies or art house pseudo movies. You know, if you like documentaries, you know, but that's the thing. You know, it's still not trying to, I think, overtly prove anything. It's actually a better documentary than most documentaries that come out now. Hmm. So it's worth your time. I don't think it's like the best movie I've seen all year, but I definitely think we're gonna hear about this movie come Oscar time.
Yeah,
I think it's gonna get some buzz. Even though, you know, I hope it doesn't get lost in the shuffle, because once end of November and December hits, I'm hoping people don't forget about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think it'll stick around long enough.
I hope so. I really do hope so.
I think it deserves to. I think it deserves to have some recognition. Mm-hmm. And I hope it gets enough recognition where people can actually go see it without having to drive far away. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest thing. You know, if you end up having to rent it or whatever, I think it's worth your money. If you have, you know, I don't know. Like I said, I think there's enough going on there that it's worth your time and it's worth sharing with other people. And then, because I think it's going to start conversations about little moments in your past that you've probably forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Conversations that you can have with your spouse. Like, you know, hey, we've been married for X number of years and we think we've shared everything, but you've usually shared the milestones or like the biggest things. Mm-hmm. And you didn't share this one thing that you realized, like I said, was impactful, even though it wasn't a milestone. So I think it's great to a great conversation starter.
Yeah.
So I endorse it. But I like I said, this is the final one. Someday people are going to say, you know, I didn't think it was a milestone that I listened to all the extra podcasts that Real World Theology did for the summer of 2014. But you know, there's this thing I just wanted to share with people. And I really appreciate everyone who's been on this summer to help make that happen. And hopefully, maybe we'll start doing more than two a month on a regular basis, but we'll see how time and finances goes. But as far as that is the case, I really appreciate Laura and Wade for being here. And because of that, I want to make sure that you, the listener, the person who has given us some of your very precious moments, has a chance to get a hold of them. So, Wade, how can people find what you do?
Well, the best place would be to go to wadebearden.com. And so I write for some different people. I do a podcast as well for christandpopculture.com. And I usually link a lot of stuff there. You can connect to my my Facebook page, and I post stuff there. And then I guess the best way, too, to follow me is on Twitter. It's at Wade Hance. It's not at Wade Bearden, because there's another Wade Bearden. Who's my arch enemy, and he gets a lot of emails from me and messages, or emails for me and messages for me. So it's Wade Hance, and I think you'll probably put it in the show notes, and so you can follow me there. And I also have just a short piece on my reaction to Boyhood on my website. But that's the best way to contact me or to check out some stuff that I've done.
Awesome, Laura. How can people get a hold of you?
They can go to laurathistle.com, and they can follow me at Twitter if they like. But I'm really bad at Twitter. My handle is @Laura_Thistle. I try so hard to keep it updated, and then I just forget about it.
I mean, is that something someone's ever really been proud of? Like, I.
Oh, there are some people on Twitter who are very proud of.
Yeah, I. Guys, I'm good at Twitter. I just wanted everyone in this room to know that I am good at Twitter.
And I'm jealous of those people.
And people are like, wow, you're good at the
Twitter?
Stop
talking about yourself.
You're good at the Twitter? I'm That's terrible it. At Twitter. I just retweet to other people because I still post everything to Facebook because I should be posting it both places. But I'm very verbose because I think the words that I say are important and people should listen to all of them. And I'm like, 140 characters?
I will need much more than
that. I won't need many more characters than 140.
I can have explained the mysteries of the universe in 140 characters.
Exactly. I can barely promote my show in 140 characters.
But you could give the synopsis for Boyhood in 140 characters.
Exactly.
This is true.
It's like the life of a young man Mason from age 5 to age 18. There it is. A tweetable.
Yes, and they're like, wow, this is so profound.
Yes, link.
Because that's what it's about, man. It's like life is like about being alive. Thanks, Mason.
It's like always right now, you know?
Dude, that's what we should do. Okay, so we should start a Twitter account called Mason's Wisdom and just tweet lots of redundant things about things. It's like rabbits, you know? Like, they're like rabbits.
Is there magic in the world?
Is there magic? I mean like magic. Stuff Mason says.
That's great.
At Stuff Mason Says. Well, I'll put all those ways to get a hold of Wade and Laura in the show notes, which you can find at realworldtheology.com, reelworldtheology.com, which hopefully you have already found because you found this podcast. But thanks so much for joining on this episode. If you do want to keep the discussion going, then you can follow @RealWorldTheo or @Fizzification on the Twitters, the social networking sphere. You can find us on Facebook or, like I said, at the website. Connect with us, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and if you enjoy it, review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends, and let's get more people involved in the conversation. And on that note, I want to send a big thank you out to, and I hope I don't mess this up really bad, to J. Mark SW, it could be Mark's W, 2012, for giving us another 5-star review on iTunes. He has some very awesome things to say about this show, and he also mentions James Harleman's Cinemagogue site, which is a great site. I would recommend almost anyone going there. It inspired me to do what I do, even though I don't think James is super proud of the fact that I point that out there. So even the fact that he mentioned, along with what James Harleman's got going on at Cinemagogue, is a high compliment to me. And most importantly, he says, as long as you keep cranking these out, I'll keep listening. So unfortunately, J. Mark SW 2012, you will have lots to listen to, because we have a huge slate of movies just for the rest of this year, not even getting into 2015 yet. So thanks so much for your feedback. Again, I just want to thank my guests for being here. Thank you, guests.
You're welcome.
Hey, thank you for inviting us.
I want to thank you, the listeners, for taking time in the little essences of moments in your life for making us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.